Coming up on Philosophy Time,
the life and thought of John Dewey,
quintessentially American philosopher,
one of the founding fathers of American pragmatism,
part philosopher, part psychologist, part educational and social reformer.
One of the fundamental problems of education in and for a democratic society is set by the conflict of a nationalistic and a wider social aim.
John Dewey and the ideal of democracy.
A democracy is more than a form of government.
For Dewey, democracy is the fundamental form of human life through which we realize our deepest ideals and aspirations.
It is primarily a mode of associated living, of conjoined communicated experience.
When are people going to learn? Democracy doesn't work!
Please don't knock the land that I love.
Our guest is Melvin Rogers, author of The Undiscovered Dewey, Religion, Morality, and the Ethos of Democracy.
The Life and Thought of John Dewey.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And we're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
And today, we're thinking about John Dewey and the ideal of democracy.
Yeah, John Dewey was just a distinctively American philosopher.
He may have been the single most influential American philosopher during his lifetime, John.
And he had a long life. He was born before the Civil War and died in the early 1950s.
And the guy was an absolute force of nature, I imagine. He was one of the founding fathers of the pragmatist school in philosophy. He was a psychologist, a political theorist, and a public intellectual. And he just didn't do this from his armchair. He worked tirelessly in the field for various causes like women's suffrage, for example. And his influence in education was, I think, transformational.
You know, there's obviously a lot we could say about Dewey, but we're going to focus on his views about democracy, of which he was a big fan.
I think maybe that's an understatement. I think he adored democracy. He thought of democracy as the ideal form of human social life.
Yeah, but talk of the ideal, anything, implies perfection. Democracy's fine. It's all right. But I don't see how anyone can think it's perfect.
Oh, what's your beef with democracy?
Well, I'm with Churchill. Democracy, he said, is the worst form of government except for all the others that have been tried.
Oh,
that's its virtue.
I think Churchill was just being ironic or something, wasn't he?
No, I think he was utterly serious. His point was that although the people may not be very good at governing, still, they're a hell of a lot better than the dictators or revolutionary vanguards or haughty elites that have been the norm throughout history.
But come on, if democracy is a little logic for you. If democracy is better than the rest, then, well, it's the best. And if it's the best, it's ideal, right? QED.
Not if it's the best of a bad lot. I used to chair the philosophy department. I think I was the best of a bad lot of choices, frankly, but far from ideal. No form of government is ideal. All we can hope for is avoiding being ruled by psychotic tyrants or petty fools, which has happened a lot throughout history.
Now, John, you have such a cramped view of democracy and government and politics for Dewey. This stuff is about really fundamental things. It involves much more than getting off your duff now and then and voting for the lesser evil. It's about more even than majority rule.
Well, like what?
Like informed activity and reflective participation in civic life? Like free and open communication among citizens? That's important. Like mutual understanding of one another's wants and needs? Like cooperation, collaboration, and compromise? Really big stuff.
Sounds kind of dreamy and unrealistic.
It sounds visionary to me.
Well, it's not a vision that truly describes any democracy I've ever heard of.
No, I don't think he was meaning to describe the way things actually are. He was articulating an ideal.
There's that word again.
Well, look, I mean, Dewey actually saw democracy, I think, as rooted in our deepest aspirations as human beings. He believed that we can realize our full human potential, even our potential as individuals, only through active participation in what he called the public sphere.
Well, I think that's where he gets off the rails. I have the duty to vote and spend a little time figuring out who to vote for. More participation than that, I don't think that's what makes my life go. It just makes me tired.
Oh, John.
Look, Dewey was a pragmatist, right?
Yeah, so what?
Well, I thought pragmatists didn't really go in for lofty and unreachable ideals. They go in for what works, what can realistically be achieved in the here and now.
Yeah, but Dewey went in for what can be achieved in the here and now. That's why he put such an emphasis on education. He didn't think democracy was easy. He said that we can achieve democracy only if we educate people in a way that prepares them for life as active, reflective, engaged citizens. And, you know, he thought a lot. That's how his transformational influence in education. He thought a lot about how to actually do that.
Well, on the matter of education, maybe Churchill and Dewey weren't so far apart after all.
What do you mean, John?
Well, I mean, Churchill thought ignorance was a problem. Have you ever taken a look at the average voter?
Oh, God.
Churchill said, talk to the average voter for 5 minutes. That's the best argument against democracy. He won't turn out to be exactly the engaged, reflective citizen of Dewey's imagining, but maybe education could get in there.
See, again, it's not about how things actually are, what the citizen is actually like. It's about how things ought to be. That's why Dewey's talking about the ideal of democracy, John.
Yeah, but think of the U.S. We're divided by religion, class, race, and ethnicity. A lot of people end up being minorities and not part of the majority. Do you ever think we can have the kind of mutual understanding that Dewey dreamed of?
Well, why not?
Well, because I think Dewey's vision is like watching a rough-and-tumble rugby game and thinking, oh, we could transform this into ballet just by education.
Well, that's a great analogy, but it's still kind of grumpy, dude. Grumpy, grumpy, grumpy.
Yeah, well, in my grumpiness, I'll give him credit. He believed deeply in education, and education deserves all the attention it can get. And he was more than just an educator and a philosopher. He was an activist, a psychologist, a woman's rights advocate, and a lot of other things.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to explore the life and times of this whirlwind John Dewey. She files this report.
John Dewey began his career as a high school teacher. He was born in Vermont in 1859, and by the end of his life at the ripe age of 92, he had an impressive list of accomplishments under his belt.
His life is actually devoted to lots and lots and lots of practical causes.
Philip Kitcher is the John Dewey Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University.
He's a very early endorser of things like female suffrage. He's a very early supporter of the NAACP.
Dewey was also a scholar of psychology, metaphysics, art, education, political theory, you name it. In 1899, Dewey was elected president of the American Psychological Association. In 1905, he became president of the American Philosophical Association. And he was a member of the American Federation of Teachers. Dewey was a pragmatist who believed philosophers should have a real-life impact on the world.
Not just kind of pie-in-the-sky ideas and talking to other scholars.
Sarah Stitzline is a professor of philosophy and education at the University of Cincinnati. She's also a Dewey scholar.
So there's this very social aspect of what citizens do for Dewey, and that's largely about solving social problems that keep democracy strong and healthy. And that's all guided by this pragmatist spirit of trying to figure out what works.
Dewey believed one way to maintain a strong democracy was through a strong public education system. He thought our classrooms should be focused on bettering society, not teaching individual vocational skills.
He drew our attention to children as unique individuals whose experience should be fostered and supported in our classrooms so that children could come to understand and investigate and improve the world around them.
When John Dewey died in 1952, not a lot of people were tooting his philosophical horn. Here's Columbia's Philip Kitcher again.
His influence really waned after his death. I mean, he basically got written out of the philosophy curriculum in most places.
Throughout Dewey's work runs a critique of capitalism, and Kitcher says that didn't bode well with the post-World War II American public. People didn't want to hear about radical reform.
This is the time of the Cold War. This is the time in which capitalism is pitted against the evils of a rival economic system. And people, I think, didn't want to listen to somebody like Dewey saying there are things that are really deeply wrong and that need to be reformed.
Kitcher says it wasn't until the 1970s that scholars started taking Dewey seriously again. We now have things like the John Dewey Society and professors at Columbia who get paid to study his life's work. Much of American society now lauds John Dewey. But what would Dewey think about today's American society?
I think he would be appalled. I mean, Dewey is very scathing about the idea that democracy is simply a matter of people voting periodically. You don't get informed decisions when on complex issues you get two people on television shouting at one another for about 10 minutes.
That's a matter of principle, and I'll tell you.
You are the single biggest liar. You probably are worse than Jeb Bush.
We both agree with campaign finance reform.
Let's talk about issues.
I worked hard for McCain-Feingold.
Nasty guy. Now I know why he doesn't have one endorsement from any of his colleagues.
I mean, I think he would think there's not a hope that people can really think through the things that matter to them and find candidates who can really advance their goals and interests.
Sarah Stitzline from the University of Cincinnati says John Dewey might be disappointed in our current democratic system, but she thinks he would still have hope.
We can't just hope in something else outside of us, but rather our hope has to relate to our own personal efforts to improve our lives as well as those of others. And all of that for him is guided by a belief in meliorism. This is kind of a positive, optimistic outlook where you believe that the world can indeed be improved with effort together.
Maybe a little meliorism can go a long way.
If Donald Trump is president...
Hold on, gentlemen, I'm going to turn this car around.
Here's hoping. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
And I'm John Perry. Thanks, Shuka, for that interesting look at the life and times of John Dewey. I'm here with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about the life and thought of John Dewey. We're joined now by Melvin Rogers. He's a professor of political science and of African American studies at UCLA. He's author of The Undiscovered Dewey, Religion, Morality, and the Ethos of Democracy. Melvin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, John and Ken. I'm delighted.
Okay, Melvin, thank you. We've got a little echo, but I'm sure that the more Melvins, the better. Now, I have a question for you. In my experience, Dewey is not a big topic for the average African-American studies department. So how did you get interested in John Dewey in the first place?
I was introduced to John Dewey by a college professor. And when I finally came around to reading Dewey, and this will sound weird if you've read Dewey, he's not especially beautiful or good writer, but when I finally came around to reading him, I experienced what I can only describe as an overwhelming feeling of joy. And let me just very briefly put this in proper context. I'm not an especially religious person. I did not grow up in the church. But when I read Dewey, I found both my religion, a particular system of faith, and my church, and I never stopped reading them.
Well, that's great. We're going to have to go to our break a little bit early, but we'll be right back.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the American philosopher John Dewey and the ideal of democracy.
Government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Dewey, diversity, and democracy, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Democracy is power to the people, the public. But who exactly is that? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about John Dewey and the ideal of democracy.
Our guest is Melvin Rogers from UCLA, author of The Undiscovered Dewey. And Melvin was explaining to us how he got interested in Dewey and how thrilled he was when he started reading Dewey. And I admit I had similar feelings, really put off by the prose, but like the idea. The world ain't perfect, but it's getting better. There's no God, but you know, that doesn't mean we can't be committed to things, and democracy's okay. Dewey loved democracy. He embraced it. Plato avoided it. Churchill tolerated it. Can you give us a brief account of why Dewey was so enthusiastic about democracy?
Yes. So Dewey, I think some people often get Dewey mistaken on democracy. Dewey was excited about democracy because he thought that democracy provided the best means by which people on the one hand could avoid being dominated, and on the other they could find a sort of system through which they could experience the sort of full flowering of their capacities and abilities.
Yeah, that's a really that's a great uplifting vision of, you know, democracy as a means to, like, realizing human potential or something like that. Even as I understood this, even for an individual, right, democracy is this way of life through which you can achieve individuality. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, Dewey thought that how we actually become the distinctive people that we are is actually dependent on our interactions, conversations, exchanges with the communities to which we belong. Why? Because those communities actually provide the resources that we rely on to make ourselves into the distinctive people that we turn out to be.
Well, that's a very optimistic vision. But don't a lot of us achieve our individuality by kind of tolerating other people, having even more fun than we do with the live ones with the dead ones through their books, and creating solitary works of great importance? What do we think about all that?
I mean, that is partly true, although I think you have something of a sort of narrow idea of what's going on actually when we're in conversation with the works, let's say, of past scholars or the works of previous thinkers. We still find ourselves located in a community stretched across time. We still find ourselves making use of the resources of that community to make ourselves into distinctive human beings.
You know, this seems to me to harken back to the sort of idealist roots, the Hegelian idealism. I know Dewey ultimately rejected idealism, but I still hear some echoes of the idealism, because the idealism says, you know, the dialectic of all rational people, we're in community with each other. This kind of spirit comes and emerges and unifies us all in politics and religion. And I know he rejected that, but it still seems like there's traces of that in him. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are still sort of traces of Hegelian idealism in him. He said that he actually never fully abandoned Hegel, but we need to sort of understand this in its proper context. For Dewey, he does not think that darkness or tragedy saturates the world in which we live. He believes that there is always a space upon which to stand, to sort of peer into the brightness, the light that may yet be. And he, in some sense, holds together both darkness and lightness together as a condition for human development, human flourishing. If it's all dark, what is the point of going on?
Yeah, that sounds cool. That sounds cool. But, you know, and it's connected to another thing that I wonder about. Like, think about Rousseau, who talked about the social will, this all-encompassing social will that summed up the vector sum or something like that of all. And then Lincoln, who talks about government of, by, and for the people. Dewey has this idea of, like, the public interest, the public sphere, the public. But who is the public? I mean, isn't the public just a collection of competing interests and desires? And then if I lose through majoritarian rule and I'm in the minority, I'm excluded from that public, right? So isn't this just kind of wishful thinking?
You know, there was in 1927, when Dewey published The Public and Its Problems, he made something of a mistake when he called it the public. Because the moment you read through the work, one of the things that you come to understand is that Dewey actually has in mind multiple publics. And publics just simply mean sort of groups of individuals that are trying to have problems that affect their life chances cared for, and have it cared for in ways that cannot be satisfied by their own hands. And so they have to create, you know, public agents or agents that in some sense become representatives. So The moment you have that in view, of course, there will be a conflict. But Dewey subscribes to the idea that through intelligent judgment, dialogue, the possibility for working through those conflicts actually exists.
Well, that all sounds good. I mean, I'm all for dialogue. I'm all for trying to work through our competing interests and, you know, mutual respect. All that sounds right. But I get the sense, look, there's a kind of approach to democratic theory that says, you know, we all start out as atomistic individuals. We enter the state because in the state of nature or the original position or whatever, we've got this massive problem that we're not constrained by each other. And then we kind of get government as a kind of compromise thing to help us solve this problem. But we start out as atomistic individuals. And now if we have common ways of seeing the world, we can get along. But if we can't, you know, if we have uncommon ways of seeing the world, if we have divergent fundamental points of view, democracy may not help, you know? I mean, big deal. Because you and John get together with your liberal poobahness and vote me out, and I'm the conservative or I'm the black guy, and you guys are the, you know? I mean, democracy, I mean, big deal. I mean, what does Dewey have to say about all this radical pluralism that we face in this moment?
I mean, I think in one sense, sort of Dewey is going to look skeptically upon the notion of radical pluralism in the context of the United States. On the other hand, Dewey is going to say that part of what sort of critical reflection allows for us to do is to actually gain some distance from the beliefs, the commitments, and the interests that we hold, such that we are open to the possibility of those interests, commitments being transformed in light of interests and commitments of other individuals that share the community with us, right? The notion of the atomistic individual doesn't make much sense, right? Because we actually need to have an account of how individuals come to have interests in the first place. And the moment in which you're trying to explain that, that's immediately going to send you to community. It's going to send you to social life. It's going to send you to interactions with other individuals, right? And now we need to explain how it is that people got on the business of forming those interests. And what will come up is critical inquiry, reflection, dialogue, and so forth.
Did Dewey have much to say about the details of the American government? I mean, we seem to have invented a system where not only does a minority not rule, but neither does a majority. Nobody rules. I mean, because a majority has to be a supermajority to get anything through the Senate. So did he give us a critique of our own system?
So Dewey thought that we were often confused about democracy. He often drew a distinction between political democracy, which includes, you know, universal suffrage, majority rule, the right to vote, process of accountability. But he also had an idea of democracy as an ethical ideal, which is what we've mostly been describing, right? I think if Dewey were looking at our political system now, especially, I think he would say, actually, it's not clear at all we even live in a political democracy. And the reason for that is that the entry fee for running for both national and local office is too high. He would point to the role of special interests and corporate money. He would point to economic inequality that frustrate the ability of people to flourish, right? He was already making these critiques in the 1930s.
Right. Well, that sounds good. I mean, he sounds like a prescient kind of guy, but I still want to get back to the theory just a little bit, right? Because I'm still wondering about I like this kind of communitarian, if you could call it that, approach. I like the idea that we don't start out as atomistic individuals, but we have our being somehow in and through this collective undertaking. That all sounds cool. But I still don't quite understand what to do about the dispossessed minority who's always on the losing side in a democracy. One of the things that is supposed to make democracy have maximum buy-in is that the minority can have a hope of a future in which he's not always the minority and all that. But, you know, that's a hope. So what does Dewey have to say about the minority in a democracy, the people on the losing side, and about why they should buy in?
So this is actually what's interesting about his conception of the public. The public actually matters because it is a vehicle by which the citizenry can articulate their grievances so that they can be systematically cared for. In the absence of a political society that takes seriously the public, society will remain stale and it will be unresponsive. And Dewey has this moment in The Public and Its Problems where he says that very logic actually gives way to revolution that is responsible for wiping away old and resistant publics to create the condition for a new society that is actually responsive to the ongoing grievances of the citizenry. So what does that mean for the minority? If, in fact, you're in a permanent position of a minority, you don't live in a democracy. It's time to wipe the slate clean.
So this question of the role of minorities, particularly dispossessed minorities, in democracy isn't just America's problem. I heard an interview with the president of Burma, whose name I unfortunately don't remember. She's a Nobel Prize winner, but still the problem with the Muslim minority there is a tremendous problem. And then in India, where the caste system and the untouchables, they've dealt with that forever. They have a thriving world's largest democracy, but they're still having problems. We have a caller with a very interesting perspective on that. That's Dayamudra from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dayamudra.
Hi, thanks. I'm really enjoying this. A lot of people don't know about Dr. Ambedkar. He's one of the most famous Indians you've never heard of. He wrote the Indian Constitution.
We actually did a show on him, Dayamudra. We actually did a show about him.
Oh, okay. I'll have to go back and listen and miss that one. But he studied with John Dewey, and he always credits John Dewey as being his most important teacher. And he graduated from Columbia in 1927 and brought John Dewey's vision for education as a tool in social change to India, including introducing a women's bill of rights way before the United States had anything like that. So there's a real, the people that I work with now in India are really influenced by Dr. Ambedkar and John Dewey's influence in terms of social change in education.
So, Dayamudra, thanks for the call. The show that we did on this was called Radical Democracy, and we talked a lot about Ambedkar's theory and its alternative form of democracy. So, but Melvin, you have any response to Dayamudra's insights.
No, I think she's absolutely, nothing substantive in the sense that she's absolutely right about this relationship between Dewey and Ambedkar. In fact, the first political party, the Independent Labour Party, that was founded in 1936, which took its name from British politics, was largely informed by Dewey's outlook of democracy and Ambedkar's wife often tells stories about the ways in which he would actually mimic or imitate Dewey's mannerisms in the classroom. Of course, this points to the sort of international reach of Dewey's political philosophy.
So Dewey, as I remember, spent a lot of time in China. I think maybe he even saved Bertrand Russell's life when they were both in China. Did he have a big influence on China?
Dewey gave a series of lectures in the sort of early 20th century in China, and it is still the case that Dewey is a sort of sage voice for Chinese intellectuals. I'm not exactly sure about how deep it runs in terms of contemporary Chinese politics.
So I want to connect this up to our caller and to something else. It sounds to me that Dewey is, there's this movement in contemporary democratic theory called the deliberative democracy movement. It sounds to me in a way that like Dewey is the first deliberative Democrat. And by that, I mean something like this. I always wonder about the deliberative democracy movement, which says the key to democracy is deliberation, shared deliberation, a conversation among citizens about what they're to do and be together. But one thing you could think of democracy is about one person, one vote, and it's about voting and schemes of voting and majoritarianism and all that sort of stuff. But it seems to me that the Deweyan thinks there's a lot more to democracy, a whole lot more than voting schemes. It's not essentially, it's partly about voting schemes, but not really essentially, not in its core. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And the reason why that's the case is that Dewey understood the sort of institutional aspects of what we associate with political democracy to be the sort of product of historical circumstances in responding to arbitrary power. It could come to be the case that down the road we come to discover that there's some new configuration of political life that we ought to use institutionally to best channel the ideal of democracy. Democracy, right? Dewey was very convinced that the hallmark of what it is to be a democratic citizen is to be constantly vigilant, right, about those who sort of exercise power on your behalf. And that requires a more active role far beyond narrow institutional politics than we're inclined to otherwise think.
Yeah, so there's a lot to talk about here, Melvin, and we've got to get to a break, but there's much more to dig into. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the political thought of John Dewey with Melvin Rogers from UCLA. In our next segment, we'll ask the question, does Dewey's vision still make sense in the age of the Internet? Twitter, Facebook, and the ideal of democracy, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
This democracy was made for you and me. Well, anyway, it was made for me. I'm from Nebraska, grown up on stolen Indian land, and I'm white. I don't know about you, but it was made for me. But does this democracy still make sense in our globalized, interconnected age? Was it even made for me anymore? I can barely get my computer to turn on. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Melvin Rogers from UCLA. We're thinking about John Dewey and the ideal of democracy. And we've got a caller, Benita, on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Benita.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
So what's your comment or question?
Well, it's kind of serendipitous that I happen to have your program on today, because I just spent the evening with John Dewey's granddaughter, who happens to be a longtime friend of mine.
Oh, really?
And
his actual honest-to-goodness granddaughter?
Yes, John Dewey's granddaughter. Joanna Dewey, her name is. She's a retired theologian. She's a New Testament scholar who pioneered feminist thinking. She's very interested in justice. And she recently retired as a dean from one of our seminaries, Episcopal seminaries. And we met because I'm an activist. I spent 20 years in the Episcopal Church fighting for gay marriage. So I very much believe in engagement with the structures of power. But also, I'm curious to know, I actually read Pragmatism as part of a course I took at Vassar. I had no idea John Dewey had such a broad impact and influence on the question of a democracy. And I'm wondering what you think he might believe about the demonstrations happening right now on the streets, as well as the protests, and just the whole thing of conscientious objection. What do you think about his perspective on activism? And I'm curious what he wrote about that.
Okay, Benita, thanks for the call. That's a great serendipitous call, Melvin. What do you think there?
So I think Dewey would think two things. First, he would say that the let's take Black Lives Matter, the activism of Black Lives Matter. He would think that it actually represents an attempt by a group of folks folks to articulate not only the problems of police brutality vis-a-vis black and brown folks, but the ways in which that concern, the police of brutality of black and brown folks, ought to be of national concern. This is how publics actually work. I think, secondly, he would actually see Black Lives Matter as indications of the vibrancy, actually, of democracy. And that may sound ironic, because obviously are they not protesting the inability of democracy to be realized? Yes, but the fact that they exist, the fact that they are hitting the streets, and the fact that their organization has achieved multiracial currency is indicative of the power of ordinary, everyday people to capture the imagination of their fellows.
So the point about, I mean, I think that's really profound what you said, and I'm really glad that Bonita's question prompted that, because I think this helps us see something. What do we meant by conversation, if I understand this all right? It's not just like polite conversation. It's not necessarily even with shared standards of shared conversational norms, right? Because a voice can come from the outside and kind of bring about a kind of rupture in the ongoing conversation. And democracy should be open to that. It's a sphere of contestation where the means of contestation can change and can be grabbed by this person and altered by that person. I mean, is that the right understanding?
Yeah, I mean, for Dewey, contestation, rivalry, competition, impolite conversation sits at the heart of what democracy is about, right?
Back to John's analogy, though, the rugby versus ballet analogy. When you stress the collaboration, understanding mutual interest and all that sort of stuff, I think that's where John thinks, oh, it sounds like ballet, because that's a deeply cooperative thing. But the rugby thing is rough and tumble, where we're trying to beat the other guy out. So is it more like ballet or is it more like rugby?
I don't think that we're trying to so much beat the other guy out as much as we're trying to sort of beat our fellows into a new way of existence. And that may sound awkward, but for Dewey, democracy created the conditions for us to experience a new kind of sort of intellectual and political death, if you will. That is to say, the old self has to die away in order for the new self to be realized, right? And in that respect, democracy is very difficult. It requires courage. It requires humility. And it requires a willingness to endure discomfort.
So, Ken, I think we should return to this issue of the internet, though. You've got a caller there that's relevant to that?
Well, yeah, there's a person who asked about, there's a person on Twitter who asked, and it's the Twitter that impresses me, also the question. The question from Twitter is vocational education, that's from Ed Gable, asks, vocational education is important as economic inequality grows in the U.S., but wouldn't Dewey be against this? So that's one thing about the kind of education, but I'm also impressed that it's coming from Twitter. But first answer his question, and then I want to talk about the Twitter thing.
Would Dewey be against vocational education?
Yeah.
No. At the core of democracy and education is a whole set of reflections on the importance of vocational training. The issue for us today, given the nature of capitalism, is that vocations actually, there needs to be jobs for one to go to once they're trained in vocations.
I think Dewey would be against kind of premature channeling of kids into vocational education, but I think the idea would be great.
There's no intrinsic opposition between education for useful work and education for citizenship. I don't think education for citizenship just is education for useful work, right? But there's no inherent conflict between those two things.
Yeah, Yeah, but the question is, how old do you have to be to demonstrate that you're not going to make a living doing philosophy?
Right. So, but the Twitter part is, so we got this input from Twitter. There's so many ways that citizens have of communicating with one another, not just through the top-down hierarchy of the press and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, can be used to manipulate, but also through Twitter and Facebook and the internet. Noise, more noise is generated. So unbalance. Right, are these new means of communication, because democracy is about citizens communicating with one another. Is the new means of communication good for democracy or bad for democracy?
You know, that's a very difficult question. I know we're on radio, we kind of want short answers. That's a very difficult question. The reason why it is a very difficult question is because with all technologies, the goodness or badness of them partly depends on the pre-existing habits and dispositions of those that are actually deploying the technology. So if it is the case that you belong to a movement, let's say, once again, Black Lives Matter, I'm inclined to say that the use of the Twitterverse, the use of social media, the use of information technology has been so crucial to expanding that organization. If, however, you use the Twitterverse, you use the internet as a way to create an echo chamber, right, such that it creates silos in political society, thus increasing partisanship, I'm inclined to say that Dewey would want to say that this is a bad thing. But all of this depends on the background, habits, sensibilities, and attitudes that's bringing you to the technology in the first instance.
Melvin, you said something that just moves my heart deeply, as implied in what you said. And I want, because I, you know, we live in Silicon Valley. I teach at Stanford University. I direct this symbolic systems program, which is a kind of technology-oriented major. And we train leaders, technological leaders. But I keep saying to people, technology is not a means, an end in itself, and it doesn't determine our future. But human institutions, human habits, human structures, which may be enhanced by technology or worsened by technology, those are antecedent to technology and determine the good or bad of technology. And did Dewey believe something like that? Was he explicit about that?
I think Dewey is very explicit about this. His reflections on science, right? Many thought that Dewey was just simply taken with science, and he had no critical perspective on it. But Dewey actually thought science, technological interventions always involved a sort of double-edged quality to them. And the reason why is because if we did not investigate the background habits and sensibilities that were shaping the context in which the science or the technology was located, we may actually be confuse what the appropriate use of that science or that technology is about, or how it ought to be used. So Dewey was always interested in trying to describe what are the requisite habits of being a democratic citizen deploying science or technology in such a way that create the conditions for broad-based flourishing.
So I mean, my guess is that Dewey would be very enthusiastic about blogging, the idea of opening the conversation to everyone and then allowing, in a very easy way, people to respond. Although I don't think he would like trolling. And I think he'd be pretty, as you suggested, pretty ambivalent about Twitter. It's fine for some things, but it can be abused. 140 words isn't quite enough. It wouldn't have been enough for Dewey to complete a paragraph, frankly.
Well, no, it wouldn't have been enough for Dewey. And with all of these things, I think we have to sort of look carefully at the context. Blogging that is widespread blogging that is tied to anonymity is going to be an issue for Dewey.
So I want to just really quickly, I mean, it seems to me that the things you said about Dewey on technology and all that also apply to the institutions of society and government, like voting. Like, it in itself is not a solution. It's just like, have a voting scheme, because voting schemes have to fit into a social structure and people with their habits of mind and all that, so that it's the people and how they relate to one another that's most fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem right?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, this is for Dewey, this is sort of the real problem that we're confronting. It's not whether or not one is able to vote or not. It is a question of, well, what in fact is one voting for? And the language of what one is voting for will be bound up to background habits and sensibilities that one is trying to sort of maintain and sustain. Donald Trump is a perfect example of this. Donald Trump appeals to the worst dispositions of the American demos. And now he is, in running for president, trying to channel that into his ascendancy to the presidency. If that were to happen, given what Donald Trump has laid out, this would actually sort of spell doom in Dewey's mind to how he thinks about democracy. Why? Because what Donald Trump values above all else is not openness, but a sense of closeness. It is not tolerance. It is intolerance. It is not reciprocity. Right?
Well, Melvin, we could go on about that one, but unfortunately, I've got to call this to a close, and I really want to thank you. This has been a scintillating conversation. So thanks so much for joining us. Our guest has been Melvin Rogers. He's a professor of political science and of African American studies at UCLA. He's author of The Undiscovered Country,
The Undiscovered Dewey,
Religion, Morality, and the Ethos of Democracy. And this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that very vibrant and growing community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now we're going to fill the public space with the fast-paced conversational thoughts of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. Jane Addams started Hull House in Chicago in 1889 with her partner, Ellen Gates Starr. Inspired by the so-called settlement houses in England, Hull House began as a kind of halfway house for recent immigrants where bright young middle-class women would help them adapt to America. John Dewey was a friend of hers. Now, what happened, Chicago's George Pullman ran the Uber of his time. Uber disrupted taxis. Pullman disrupted trains. He offered luxury cars with chandeliers, black walnut interiors, steak, oysters, if you had to go cross-country, you could spend the week in style. They were very popular in that ostentatious age. Pullman was worth $24 billion in today's dollars. He built a town in Illinois for his workers, also called Pullman. Workers couldn't own their houses, but the rent was relatively low. The sticking points? He was kind of against drinking, so there was only one bar in town at the one hotel. He did have a library full of books, selected by the company, and a theater with plays selected by the company. The houses were nice, but all the same. And you had to live there if you wanted to advance in the company. So he's kind of a hero to workers with grumbling and kind of a hero to bosses with grumbling. Well, there was a crash. Pullman cut wages but didn't lower rents. So there was a walkout and a lockout. The Civic Federation of Chicago formed a committee to try to calm things down. Jane Addams was on that committee. To no avail. The managers at the railroad yards staged a train stoppage and blamed it on the union. Tricky. 1,000 federal troops were called in, and that was that for that strike. Despite her own even-handedness in this strike, Jane Addams came to be seen as prejudiced. This hurt contributions to Hull House, now seen as pro-worker. Beyond that, the Pullman strike had a huge life-changing effect on her. She and John Dewey exchanged letters about it. There was class antagonism inevitable. Dewey believed that to be true. Ms. Addams wrote, quote, "The antagonism of institutions was always unreal. It was simply due to the injection of personal attitude and reaction. And then instead of adding to the recognition of meaning, it delayed and distorted it," unquote. Antagonism even poisoned positive outcomes, she believed. She wrote, "We freed the slaves by war, and now I had to feed them all over again individually, and pay the cost of the war, and reckon with the added bitterness of the Southerner beside." She did not think that antagonisms were caused by, in Dewey's words, objective differences, which would always grow into unity if left alone, but by a person's mixing in his own personal reactions. She thought a person was antagonistic because he took pleasure in opposing others, because he desired not to be a moral coward, or because he felt hurt or insulted. These are all avoidable and unnecessary reactions, totally outside of the right and wrong of a conflict. If there is antagonism, it cannot end well. Dewey later wrote to his wife, quote, "I can see that I've always been interpreting dialectic wrong end up. The unity is the reconciliation of opposites instead of the opposites as the unity in its growth. I never had anything take hold of me so," unquote. Jane Addams changed her approach to Hull House. Rather than imposing on clients what she thought they needed, she listened to them and gave them what they wanted. She would bring them to her presentation so she would not be viewed as an outside expert. Mistakes improved her practices. With Hull House, Jane Addams introduced the NGO, the social worker, the social justice warrior, and the first community center. In recent years, she's been recognized more and more as a philosopher in her own right. She certainly influenced John Dewey. Hull House itself, alas, went bankrupt in 2012. Its laid-off workers were underpaid with their final check and were left no medical or health benefits and no pension. And so it goes. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave McAllister is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topeat, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And also from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Maybe it's not the politicians who suck. Maybe something else sucks around here. Like the public. Yeah, the public sucks. There's a nice campaign slogan for somebody.